Hopkins. Bryant for the win.
Interviews from your favorite local coaches and athletes.
He's getting to the basket of will, and he's hitting that three-point shot with some consistency now, and he's just in a groove right now where he's pretty well unstoppable.
Hall of Fame and legendary guests.
I was driven by loving to play, liking the challenge of being an NFL quarterback, but after 18 years, I was 1 month short of 39 years old. It's time to go.
Analysis and insight on the latest national sports topics. Live from the Auto Farm Studios, it's Drive Time Sports with Jordan Buscarini on KOAL 107.3 FM and 7:50 AM.
We're back for a brand new week of Drive Time Sports. We're live from the Auto Farm Studios right here on 107.3 FM and 7:50 AM. I'm your host, Jordan Buscarini. We already had a Utah Jazz playoff game today. Earlier on KOAL, Jazz Nuggets. Overtime contest, Denver picks up a win 135-125. Despite the loss, Donovan Mitchell had the third highest scoring playoff game in the history of the NBA. He dropped 57 for the Jazz today, only been outdone by Elgin Baylor and Michael Jordan. That's how historical Donovan Mitchell was. So the first game in the bubble for the playoffs, it definitely did not disappoint. Jazz are up 109-105 with a minute 45 to play in this game. And Mitchell gets called for an 8-second violation with no pressure. Denver was not pressing. Nuggets get the ball, knock down a 3-point shot. All of a sudden, that 4-point game, which could have been 7, is all the way down to 1. That was the difference in the game. And you hate to beat up on Donovan because he was phenomenal. But this is my one problem with the Jazz. I just don't know if they can score enough points. The Nuggets did not play any defense in this contest, and Utah scored 25, 27, 31, 32, and 10. Typically, that's enough to get you a win, but there's so much more. Again, we talked about this last week. You got to pay more attention to the variables than just the numbers, right? This was an up and down, back and forth game, and the Jazz defense was phenomenal in the third quarter. This was Utah's game for the taking. And they came up short. So if Donovan scores 57 and the Jazz score 125 and they still cannot beat the Nuggets, what are we to make of this series? I mean, I think the Jazz can play with the Nuggets, and I said that on Friday. While I'm taking Denver to win the series, I think the Jazz can make this interesting, and they certainly did today. That was a game that they should have won. Jamal Murray for Denver was fantastic. 36 points, 9 assists, 5 rebounds. A little bit disappointed in Utah's defensive performance. I mean, he gave up 37 in the fourth quarter to the Nuggets. That can't happen. This team just cannot score enough points to win consistently to give up 37 points in the fourth. I mean, this is a team that prides themselves on defense. And to me, it's really that simple when you break it down. I saw some great things from the Jazz today. Donovan, outside of his 57 points, Donovan had 9 rebounds and 7 assists. And the efficiency aspect of Donovan, I thought, was just fine offensively as well. It wasn't an inflated 57. I mean, he was 19 of 33 from the field. You'll take that 10 out of 10 times. That's efficient basketball. But it wasn't enough to get this victory. I think we have a long series. We'll talk more about this a little bit later on in the show. I think the Jazz get a game or two. But ultimately, I just don't think they have enough firepower. Remember today, they did not have Mike Conley. And they did not have Bojan Bogdanović. Two very big missing components to this Jazz team, and they come up 10 points short of the Denver Nuggets. Now, we have a fun one brewing right now between the Raptors and the Nets. Toronto led this game by 30, and the Nets have actually come back to cut it to single digits. It was 37-20 Toronto at the end of the first quarter, and then Toronto outscored Brooklyn by 5 in the second. So do the math. They're up by 22 at halftime. In the third quarter, they led by 29 points. And Brooklyn is fighting, chipping away. They outscored Toronto 31-19 throughout the first 10 minutes of the third quarter. We'll keep you updated on this game. Round one of the NBA playoffs off and rolling, and we have day basketball all day long. Plenty of other games to get into here in about, 20 minutes. Philadelphia at Boston. I shouldn't say at Boston. It's all in the bubble in Orlando. But the Celtics are the home team based on being the 3 seed, Philadelphia the 6. And then in the nightcap tonight, Dallas will take on the Clippers, 7 p.m. start time of that contest. So we still have a couple of games to get through. 4 games a day is basically the way this is going to work. Remember, every other day, teams are going to be playing. So a lot of basketball inside the bubble in Orlando, which again has worked out beautifully. Everything's still on pace as we get down to the final 16 teams. Let's take a look at Major League Baseball. We do have one game going on right now, the Cardinals and the Cubs. You're going to see a lot of Cardinal baseball. They had that long, long layoff because of COVID-19. Cardinals up right now with the Cubs. This one going into the fourth inning. 1-0 Cardinals with the lead. It's a game one of a doubleheader. These two teams will meet again at 6:15 tonight. Full slate of baseball games. 5:05, we get Toronto at Baltimore. And the Orioles have played well. They are 12-9. Alex Cobb will be on the mound for the Orioles. Hyun Ryu for the Blue Jays. 5:05 tonight, Red Sox-Yankees. The Yankees at 15-6, still 9-1 at New Yankee Stadium. The Red Sox struggling all over the place, just 6-16 on the season. Nationals-Braves coming up tonight at 5:10. Anibal Sanchez will take the mound for the Nationals. Remember how good Sanchez was in the playoffs for the Nats? Well, he wasn't the reason they won the World Series. He definitely helped. I mean, that rotation was lights out in the postseason, and a lot of it had to do with Sanchez. They got positive outings so far this year. Sanchez has been anything but consistent. He's got a 9.6 ERA, he's 0-3. Nats Braves, 5:10 start time between those two. Mets will take on the Marlins. The Marlins slowly coming back down to earth. They're now 9-6 on the season. The Mets still 5 games under .500. 6:10 tonight, we get the Tigers and the White Sox. The White Sox, they were one of those sexy picks in the offseason. 11-11, they'll throw Gio Gonzalez out on the mound tonight. He's got a 6.6 ERA, not great. 6:10, we get the Royals and the Twins. The Twins are at 14-8 right now. That was my pick out of that division. It's a good-looking team. 6:15 tonight, we get the Cubs and the Cardinals. Once again, game two of the doubleheader. The Padres will take on the Rangers. Zach Davies on the mound for San Diego. He's been a bright spot for this Padre team. We've got some bad news this morning. Tommy Pham, one of their big free agent moves, fractured his hand yesterday. He's out for at least a month. And so the Padres, who are now under .500, we'll try to move on with one of their prized outfield free agent pickups of the offseason. The Rockies, who were sitting at 13-8, will take on the Astros, who are finally playing better ball. They're at 11-10. It's 7:40 tonight. The red-hot Oakland A's will take on the Arizona Diamondbacks. 7:40, Giants-Angels. The Angels trying to recover off of a sweep from the Dodgers. I don't know if you watched any of this series at all, but Mike Trout, best player in baseball. I think a lot of people could make that argument. I'm not going to argue it if you tell me Mike Trout's the best player in baseball. Extra inning game on Saturday night. Dodgers are up 6-5. Because of the extra inning rule, the Angels get a runner on second base. 2 outs, Mike Trout comes up, runner on second. He doesn't even wave the bat at the ball. 3 straight pitches, Kenley Jansen strikes him out. That is so unlike Mike Trout. I bounced back yesterday, knocked a home run. But boy, when you think of the extra inning games and getting a runner on second base, Mike Trout should be a guaranteed advancement of that runner, you would think. Did not even wave the bat of the ball. I was a little bit disappointed in Trout on Saturday night. And also tonight, 7:40, Mariners-Dodgers. They'll begin their series. The Dodgers right now at 16-7. Finally playing the type of baseball that I think everybody expected. In fact, just looking at it right now, the Dodgers and the A's have the two best records in Major League Baseball. The A's are a half game better than the Dodgers, although the Dodgers have won 5 consecutive. Both the Astros and the A's have won 4, so there's 3 of the hottest teams in baseball right now. The Yankees have won 5 in a row as well. So you're starting to see the contenders kind of rise to the crop. That's a look at what's happening schedule-wise in the national sports front. I'm excited about today's show. Here in just a moment, we're going to be joined by Jim Hawk. He's an author. He's got a new book that is out. It's called Father on the Line. Jim Hawk's father, John Hawk, was an offensive lineman for the Los Angeles Rams. They were Los Angeles' first professional sporting team, and I think there's a lot of interesting tidbits in this story that you might not be aware of. Kind of a history lesson. I'm looking forward to talking to Jim Hawk. Right now, the Rams and the Chargers are actually featured on Hard Knocks, which is airing on HBO, so if you have that craving for football, We're going to get the NFL before we get college football, so you can pay attention to Hard Knocks. Big feature on the Rams and the Chargers because the new stadium is opening up. And so when this interview opportunity popped up, I thought, let's get a history lesson on Los Angeles football. The Dodgers and the Lakers, yes, they run Los Angeles, second biggest media market in the country, but it was the Rams that were the first professional sports team, and I think we're going to have a fun conversation with Jim Hawk. That's coming up next segment. We'll talk more Utah Jazz basketball as well. Plus, I'm going to give you the recap of what went down with Carbon and Emery this past Friday. Both teams coming up on the short end of the stick. You can get the complete game recap at CastleCountryRadio.com, but we'll dive into that in just a moment. It's a Monday edition of Drive Time Sports, and we are live from the Auto Farm Studios right here on 107.3 FM and 750 AM.
I understand you're a real sports fan.
Well, then there's only one answer.
Turn on the radio.
You'll never have to compromise again.
You're listening to Drive Time Sports with Jordan Buscarini on KOAL 107.3 FM at 750 AM.
Welcome back to Drive Time Sports. We're live from the Auto Farm Studios. I'm your host, Jordan Buscarini. We're going to talk some football. I'm excited for this next guest. I love getting authors on the show. Love talking about in-depth stories that maybe we have forgotten or simply don't know about. And I'm hoping we're going to get a history lesson on Los Angeles football. Our next guest is Jim Hawk. He's the author of the new book, Father on the Line. He had a dad by the name of John Hawk who played for the Los Angeles Rams during a very interesting era in LA football, and this book recently hit the shelves. And again, Jim Hawk is joining us right now over the phone. Jim, it is a pleasure to get you on the show today. Thank you so much for the time.
Jordan, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here as well. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it as well. And I know that there's obviously more that goes into the book when we talk about Father on the Line. You're the son of a former NFL football player, John Hawk. And so right out of the gate, I guess Los Angeles Rams, you bleed blue and yellow. You and I were having a conversation off the cuff. We have something in common. We're both Rams season ticket holders. And so I think that alone gives this book kind of a different perspective. I mean, you're the son of a former NFL player, but you're a fan of the franchise. And Jim, that's unique.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's, you know, where my dad played for the Rams, well, both my parents kind of grew up, you know, right around the LA Coliseum. And as we were talking earlier, Jordan, the LA Coliseum is just an iconic location for football. It's one of the greatest stadiums in the world. And so it's this story of kind of writing about my dad and his, you know, experience with the Rams and as a, you know, a quiet, humble offensive lineman on a team that was filled with big stars in a city of stars. To me, it was a fascinating, opportunity. And it really was a labor of love, too, because I wrote it after my dad had passed away from cancer. And the first story in the book is when my older brother, I'm the youngest of seven, punches me in the arm and says, hey, you know, after listening to my dad's teammates talk about, you know, each other and our dad after the memorial service. And my brother hits me in the arm and said, hey, man, you really need to write this up. And lo and behold, I never meant for it to become a book. I just wrote it for my family. And, you know, my oldest is now 18, was just born, and I wrote it for him and my mom. And then I have a friend in the book business, and it became a book. And so it was a really interesting process. It was I'm not an author by trade, you know, I work in business, but it was a really fun opportunity to talk to his friends and colleagues and teammates and also, you know, kind of deal with the loss of a parent, too, you know, something we all go through.
And I think you come from an interesting perspective as well, because there's a lot of pressure to put a book out of this magnitude, because you're talking about a very historical time in Los Angeles Ram or Ram franchise history in general. But with that being said, you also have to make sure that you give enough credit, right, to your father, in a sense. I mean, that's a lot of pressure, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a balancing act, right? I mean, the original genesis or motivation of the book, again, was to kind of talk about my dad in the context of his team. And you know, it was part of Hollywood at the time. And L.A. was, like, exploding in growth with people moving, you know, from all over the country to Southern California post-World War II. So, yeah, it was really a balancing act of trying to make sure that I talked about my dad and my mom and their relationship, and then also kind of this team that and just the personalities on that team, which is filled with Hall of Famers, you know, like Elroy Crazy Legs Hirsch and Norm Van Brocklin, the quarterback, but also, you know, people in the front office, like Pete Rozelle, who was their public relations guy and their general manager, and Rozelle became, you know, took a lot of what he learned from the Rams and became commissioner at the ripe old age of 33 in 1960. They called him the boy commissioner, but he took a lot of the innovations that he was doing with the Rams and took it, you know, kind of to the National Football League, which put the whole entire league on the map.
Yeah, and you mentioned some of those really big personalities that your father shared this team with. I mean, Van Brocklin, Elroy Hirsch, Bob Waterfield, Dick Knight, Train Lane. I mean, we can go on and on and on. Several Ram legends. I mean, again, the 1950s, it is an historical decade for this franchise. So as you start to put together a story on your dad's career, it didn't begin with the Los Angeles Rams. John Hawk's career did not begin with the LA Rams. He became a Ram a little bit later on, what, 2-3 years after he made his debut in the NFL, goes to one Pro Bowl. What was the most fascinating aspect for you of your father's career?
Yeah, there's multiple aspects. I mean, I think that the fundamental aspect of it is, you know, he was an offensive guard. His career was cut short by an injury, which happens to a lot of people. He made the Pro Bowl, and then the next year he blows out his knee, and then it was over after 6.5 years. But you're right, he went to Santa Clara University in Northern California, and then they were a burgeoning football power, believe it or not. Now they don't even have football, but they won the Orange Bowl in my dad's senior year and were highly ranked and beat the highly ranked University of Kentucky football team coached by a guy by the name of Bear Bryant. And then my dad was drafted by the Chicago Cardinals, a guy by the name everyone knows, Curly Lambeau, longtime coach of the Packers, Lambeau Field named after him. And he came to recruit my dad in his dorm room in Santa Clara. And there's a funny story in the book that my dad relayed to us as kids that, you know, Curly Lambeau is this, you know, 70-something-year-old coach of the Chicago Cardinals. They had given him a piece of the franchise, but here he is sitting on my dad's dorm room bed in Santa Clara, which was a Catholic school, Jesuit school, and the only thing my dad could think about was the fact that Curly Lambeau's extender cigarette was going to drop ashes on his bed and the priest would get mad at my dad.
Again, our guest right now is Jim Hawk. He is the author of the book Father on the Line. It's a story chronicling his father's career, John Hawk, who was most memorable career moments came with the Los Angeles Rams. Let's talk about some of those career memorable moments, including the 1955 season. And for those who are unaware just how significant this Ram team is to history, this was a squad that played in front of a million people. They were the first to do that. Also, as far as the significance of TV, I mean, people in Los Angeles have become the first fans of the country to watch their NFL team play home games on TV. I mean, it's an historical decade all the way around, not just what happened on the field. But 1955, they go up against the Green Bay Packers, final regular season home game. It's close to 100,000 spectators in the building, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely. It was the Western Division Championship. And Jordan, you're absolutely right. The Rams were the first team to ever have a million fans in the stadium, for a season. And they had that, you know, consistently 80,000, 90,000 filling the Coliseum. The Coliseum that day was packed to the gills. My mother would tell stories about how there were people literally sitting in the aisles to watch that game. The Rams had won 31-17, really hard-fought game, but my dad got the game ball that game for just incredible blocking. And Sid Gilman, who was the head coach, who's also a Hall of Famer, and many would say the architect of the modern passing game, you know, handed them the game ball, and that game ball sat prominently on our mantle in our house growing up.
Oh, absolutely. I could only imagine. And while that game is so historical, the championship game that season, it's not as historical for the Rams, but it actually took place in Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum. Again, a stadium with so much history. The Rams come up short, losing to the Cleveland Browns 38-14. It is a forgettable moment in Ram history.
Yeah, unfortunately, the Browns were the dominant team of the 50s, and the Rams were kind of the always the bridesmaid, never the bride, except for one championship in the early 1950s. So it was a consistent thing that the Rams would lose to the Browns, unfortunately. Sounds crazy to say that today, but the Browns were the powerhouse of the 1950s.
Yeah, as you said, crazy to say it today, but yes, again, a historical franchise, but you look at what happened back in the 50s, kind of the tale of two tales. One of the interesting aspects of this book, and Jim, I haven't been able to read the whole thing, but I know that there are several references to Walt Disney, okay? And that fascinates me as well, because if it's not Los Angeles sports, I'm highly into Walt Disney. I think it's a very interesting story all the way through and through, and you can make several connections to what was going on with his Ram football team, and also, well, the Walt Disney-esque type of inventiveness that went around this football team.
Absolutely. So it's a great question, Jordan. So Walt Disney, obviously everyone knows him from Disney fame, but a little known fact about Walt Disney as well was his son-in-law, Ron Miller, was married to his daughter, Diane, was a player with the Rams in the mid-1950s, a tight end, and great guy, good friend of my dad's. And so Walt Disney would often be at the Rams games, and my mom would always say, you know, see him and very interested in kind of how the Rams were doing. But yeah, the Rams try, you know, just like Walt Disney was innovating in lots of different ways, both with, you know, theme parks and which I cover in the book. The opening of Disneyland was in 1955, and there's a vignette in the book about that, how the Rams would get free tickets as a marketing deal to go to Disneyland, but they also built Disneyland in about under a year, which is just incredible to think about today.
Right.
To get built, especially with SoFi Stadium, you know, taking almost 5 years to get built. But the Rams were filled with those types of, you know, people kind of in and around the team. Bob Hope was also, the famous comedian, was also a minority owner of the team at the time as well. So, you know, you constantly had people in the stadiums. It was, you know, Showtime, the old Lakers Showtime before Showtime at the LA Coliseum.
Yeah, I think it really is. It gets overlooked, maybe not in the you know, in the city of Los Angeles, but throughout the country. I think it gets overlooked that the Rams returning to Los Angeles was a big deal, because that was LA's first professional sports squad. I know we think about the Dodgers, we think about the Lakers, and don't get me wrong, Los Angeles is a Dodger and Laker city. There's no question about it. But the Rams were the first, and when you go back historically and look at the fingerprints of the Rams on the city of Los Angeles, it's unmistakable. I mean, this was a big deal.
Absolutely. There's a story in the book, which I found fascinating. I have a friend named Roz Wyman, who was a young city councilwoman in L.A. in the 50s, and she was one of the people that were instrumental in bringing the Dodgers, along with the mayor at the time. They convinced Walter O'Connor to bring the Dodgers from Brooklyn to Los Angeles. And, you know, we interviewed Roz extensively. She's quoted in the book, but they looked to the Rams, because you're right, the Rams were first in Los Angeles, and they proved that you could do professional sports in a major city like LA that was growing just tremendously every year, with thousands and thousands of people moving from all over the country and growing, you know, significantly. So there was a market there, and fans are great in Los Angeles. You know, you have to be a winner, but they're incredibly loyal, and the Rams were the first original pro sports franchise in Southern California.
Again, Jim Hawk, our guest right now, as we talk about Father on the Line, his latest book. It was just released a couple of days ago. As we will now talk about your father's career here a little bit. And one of the things that it will become obvious in this book, Jim, your dad, as you mentioned, his career was kind of cut short due to some injuries, dealt with a lot of knee injuries. And this was during a time where, you hate to say they played for the love of the game, but boy, they basically did. I mean, we're not talking about million-dollar contracts here. We're talking about really just playing the game of football because you love to play the game of football. And today, there's all this awareness being brought up with injuries and concussions. That didn't exist back when your father played in the 50s.
Absolutely not. There was so little knowledge of, you know, obviously the CTE and brain injuries and that type of thing. The equipment was just terrible compared to today. But Jordan, you talked about playing for the love of the game. Yeah, I tell a story in the book about how we did some research on the amount of money my dad made versus my mom. And my mom was a third grade teacher when they were first married, and he was the first professional football player. And they basically made the same amount of money, which is just incredible to think about. A Pro Bowl NFL offensive lineman making roughly the same as a third grade teacher in a city school in LA. So quite a different time.
No question. No question. Jim, what's the biggest aspect you hope readers take away from this book? I know you've mentioned everything that's gone into it. You're not really a writer by choice, by trade. But when you really dig into it and you go through and you read the book, what's the biggest takeaway you want the listeners to have?
Well, I think, thank you. That's a great question. I think one is that, you know, just there's regular folks, the workhorses like my dad, and on a football team, as you know, Jordan, offensive linemen are the workhorses, the folks that don't get a lot of notoriety, kind of show up every day and do the hard work. Not that other players don't on the team, the quarterbacks and others, but they don't necessarily get all the glory. And whether it's a football team or a radio station or a Hollywood movie set or a company or a school, there's all those folks that, you know, do the tough work. They show up every day and they don't, you know, make the newspapers, what have you. And I just find it fascinating that those are the type of folks that drive society and move society forward and make communities what they are. And that was my dad. He was just one of those solid guys, and he just showed up all the time. He was a workhorse. He was a person of integrity and decency, and just had a great friends. And so that's the kind of main message, is like, here's, you know, a story of someone who may not have gotten all the notoriety, but, you know, has cast a pretty good legacy.
The book is called Father on the Line. Again, Jim Hawk joining us. Jim, before I let you go, definitely have to give you the opportunity to let the listeners know where they can find the book, and also your previous work as well, which you said this one's kind of an extension of the previous book that you had written.
Yeah, it's an update. My first book was Hollywood's Team, and this is kind of an updated version of Hollywood's Team. This is kind of a more personal look. And where people can find it, you can go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any independent bookstore, wherever books are found, you can just type in Father on the Line, and it'll come up, and you can purchase it.
Well, Jim, I definitely enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much for taking out the time, and hopefully we talk again real soon.
Absolutely, Jordan. Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Fun conversation to have on the first Los Angeles sports team. Again, that's Jim Hawk talking about his book, Father on the Line. We're going to break for just a moment. More Drive Time Sports coming up when we return. Again, we are live from the Auto Farm Studios on 107.3 FM and 750 AM. Shouldn't be a big surprise that the Toronto Raptors pick up a victory over the Brooklyn Nets. Toronto should sweep that series. I can't believe how bad Brooklyn is. I honestly think Toronto got bored out there today. I mean, Brooklyn outscores Toronto by 13 in the third. They chipped away at a 30-point deficit, got it down to 8, then Toronto kicked it back into high gear. I mean, seriously, looking at this Nets roster, the only positive I can see right now is Caris LeVert is going to be a third option for this team when Durant and Irving return next year healthy. I mean, really, other than that right now, there's no positives about this team. Garrett Temple, he's starting today. He started. He played 35 minutes for this Brooklyn Net team. Joe Harris? Do you even know who these guys are that I'm naming off to you? This is a team that was really put together a lot of patchwork due to the amount of players that either A, opted out, or B, were hurt. Spencer Dinwiddie, Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, the list goes on and on and on. I guarantee you, if you're a hardcore basketball fan, you've never even heard of who's coming off of their bench. I mean, this is a bad, bad basketball team. Toronto will get this series out in 4 games. There's no question about it. With Denver up 1-0, Toronto up 1-0, we get Philadelphia and Boston. And this looked like a potential Eastern Conference championship preview at the beginning of the year. If you would have told me Boston, Philly, Eastern Conference Finals, I could buy it. I know Jameson Welsh, our Drive Time Sports NBA analyst, he liked Philly so much at the beginning of the year, he picked them to get to the NBA championship. And now they enter this series with the Celtics, 6-point underdogs going into tonight's game. They don't have Ben Simmons, and that's really unfortunate because the Sixers, they were 3-1 against Boston when they had Ben Simmons. Now he's out due to an injury, but I did find Brad Stevens' comments a little interesting. When asked about the Simmons-less 76ers, he said that they're number one in offense because the spacing in the shooting around Embiid, who is now posting up, has changed. A bunch of shooters around him and Al Horford makes them very difficult. The Sixers did go 4-4 during the seeding portion of the restart. They ended 2-3 in a stretch of games without Simmons. Still, I think Brad Stevens is being kind to this team. I know people in Utah don't like Ben Simmons. Go ahead and throw the Donovan Mitchell thing out the door. I don't care anything about Rookie of the Year. That means absolutely nothing to me. This kid's good. And without Simmons, you're losing an aspect of your team that nobody else has. Okay, so now Boston, Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, you got Kemba Walker. This is a pretty good team. It's a very good team. Semi Ojeleye as well. I mean, they have some weapons. Marcus Smart. I like this Boston Celtic team. I think Boston's going to take Philadelphia out relatively soon, 5-6 games. And Travis, really, when you're looking at the way the NBA playoffs could in fact play out, it's really the no home court is starting to seek in, right? It's start today. I'm watching the Jazz, I'm watching the Nuggets, and this is starting to seek in. the Jazz, they just got to win. They got to win 4 out of 6 games. I mean, you're not fighting for home court. You're not fighting to protect home court. I mean, it's a neutral site. And we'll talk about the Jazz and the Celtics next segment. But when I look at what's happening in say, a Boston and Philly series, it really changes the dynamic all the way around.
Yeah, because Philly's a horrible road team. So they don't have to go into Boston and, you know, win a game. All they have to do is win, you know, neutral site games. So it benefits like a team like the Sixers who struggle on the road.
It really does. It really does. Now, I think in the same sense, it affects a team like Utah and Denver who have distinct home court advantages.
You feed off that crowd. That's where their defense...
Elevation.
You know, yeah, and they the energy like from the crowd is where you're going to see like defense. When there's no crowd there, you're going to see high-scoring games like we're seeing because there's no crowd, and you know people feed off you know the crowd for their defense.
Could you have imagined Donovan Mitchell dropping 57 at Vivint?
No, the roof would have blew off that place.
Could you imagine that?
And it would have rattled Denver so much, who knows what happens.
Well, I don't know that he does that at the Pepsi Center, but
no.
that's a lot of... You can't really have that conversation, but the bottom line is, this is going to change things up drastically. I mean, just looking at the Toronto-Brooklyn game, that score is now final. Toronto 134, Brooklyn 110. And that doesn't mean... They could play on Pluto. Toronto's going to win this series in 4 games. But even in tonight's game, I mean, the Clippers and the Mavericks... I guess I'm in the complete minority. I think Dallas gets a game, maybe even 2 in the series. And I think it matters that there's no home court here.
Yeah, Dallas is very good offensively. They just don't know how to close. If they knew how to close, they're not a 7th seed. They're probably a 4 or 5 seed.
Yeah, but they don't know how to close, and they don't have to go on the road.
Luka hasn't figured that part out yet on how to close games. He's so good, but when it comes down to crunch time, he hasn't figured that part out yet.
And they were a team that was really good on the road. They're 9 games above 500.
They don't have to worry about going to Staples Center now, yeah.
So to me, this changes things up drastically. Let's take one more quick commercial break. We'll come back. We'll talk about the Utah Jazz, who had a phenomenal performance from Donovan Mitchell. That's coming up next when we return right here on Drive Time Sports, again live from the Auto Farm Studios.
You're listening to Drive Time Sports on KOAL AM 750. The play-by-play home of the Emory Spartans.
Back for the final touches on this edition of Drive Time Sports. Let's stick with the NBA. We talked NFL earlier. Let's continue on with the NBA. I wanted to go a little bit deeper into that last segment. But due to time constraints, we had to get out for a quick break. Travis, we'll end by talking about Donovan Mitchell. He was incredible today. He scored 57 points. Again, the 3rd highest scoring output in NBA playoff history. Only Elgin Baylor and Michael Jordan have scored more points in a playoff game than Donovan Mitchell.
They all lost, right?
Yeah, they did. They all lost, which tells you the difference in playoff basketball. But still, Donovan put the Jazz in a position to get a win today. The only thing that truly worries me about Donovan's performance today is that I'm looking for the offensive punch for Utah. We've been looking and looking. They got to have more offense. There's no Bojan Bogdanovic. He's out. There's no Mike Conley. So Juwan Morgan gets a start today for the Jazz, right? You're looking, where's the offense going to come from? Clarkson does Clarkson things. Scores 18 points off of the bench. That's what we expect.
And drive you nuts in the process.
And Donovan scores 57, and they still lose. That's worrisome in the series.
They don't know how to defend the pick and roll with Joker and Jamal Murray. That's a problem because Denver's going to continue to run that.
A lot of teams don't know how to do that.
Yeah, Utah has no answer for that. You can't have Joe Ingles on Jamal Murray. He got roasted all game. That's got to change. So defensively, we knew the Jazz had problems. Offensively, I didn't think they... I mean, they're an all-right offensive team, but the defensive end of the floor is where Utah's supposed to be really good and excel.
They weren't good at all
today. They had no answer for Murray, and they don't know how to defend the pick and roll, and you got to get rebounded. I think they were out-rebounded today, weren't they?
Yeah, they were.
So, yeah, and that's a problem. So, if you're getting out-rebounded, and that can't happen either because I think the Jazz are a better, you know, rebounding team than Denver.
And like I said, there's a lot of nuances. I mean, you have to look at the way the flow of the game was going. You can't just look at the statistics and say, well, this happened, and this is why this went down the way it went down. Actually, no, the Jazz actually out-rebounded Denver, excuse me. They did that by 11 today, but it was on the offensive glass where the Jazz really need to make their money. Rudy Gobert had 4 offensive boards. Donovan Mitchell had 2 offensive boards. Tony Bradley had 4, right? So, like I'm saying, the nuances to the game fit for Utah to get this victory. Jamal Murray's really good, right? This is a good Nugget basketball team.
They're deep.
Jamal Murray is good. Jokic is very good. Michael Porter is very good. He's ahead of schedule as to where he was at. Grant is good coming off of the bench. They are just a lot more deep than this Jazz team. And not having Mike Conley today definitely didn't help matters any. There's no question it didn't help matters any. For as bad as he's been throughout the year, you literally have no point guard out on that court. And if you want to consider Jordan Clarkson a point guard, go right ahead. I don't consider him a point guard.
Nor do I.
And so, really, the only point guard on this team is Emmanuel Mudiay. He played 10 minutes today. You have to have Mike Conley in a series like this. Then again, let me ask you this. Does Donovan score 57 if he's got Mike Conley out on the court with him?
No, because he's not going to have the ball in his hands that much. Conley's a guy that gets others involved. Mitchell, I don't think he does that. He had 7 assists, I believe, or 9 assists, whatever it was.
Yeah, 9 assists, yeah.
But he doesn't put guys in the spots they need to be, and I think Conley does that.
Well, that's fair. 7 assists, 9 rebounds, 7 assists for Donovan Mitchell today. No, and that's fair because Mike Conley has been a very efficient point guard
because
for a long time in the NBA.
Because Mitchell's score-first mentality, yeah, and Conley's not. So it's not a harp on Donovan Mitchell. It's just the other guys are not going to be, you know, that involved if Mitchell has to have the ball in his hand so much, which he had to today. And he had to be that good today to give themselves a chance to win, and they just came up short.
This series goes how many games?
You and I were talking about this, Friday on our way to do the Emory game. Before I knew about the Conley situation, I thought it could go 7. I think it goes 5.
They can get one. They can get one. There's no question. Donovan's going to have to be phenomenal, and he was, outside of the 8-second violation. And you hate for one specific play to override everything that you accomplished. You scored 57 points.
But that changed
everything. You did something right. But if you didn't follow the game, with a minute 46, I think, was left of the game. Minute 48, minute somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
An uncontested 8-second violation, and Donovan owned up to it at the end of the game. But how big was that? Well, it's 109-105 Jazz. They have the ball. Let's say you get a 24-second violation. You don't score. It's still 109-105 with a minute 20 to play in the game. You're just playing the percentages. Things are definitely going to break in your favor. Not only did they give up the 8-second violation uncontested, they allowed Denver to hit a 3-point shot almost immediately.
Got it to 1, yeah.
That was a 5-point minimum swing. And that right there was the difference in the game. And like I said, you hate to look at everything that Donovan accomplished.
But that's the one play
that stings, man. That stings.
It hurts because they had no answer for him. So if he just gets the ball up court, he was getting to the basket. They probably foul him and he gets to the line. And it's
6.
It's 6. And then you put Denver in a real deep hole.
You know, this team can shoot the lights out from beyond the arc, and Jazz fans knew that coming into today. I'm not telling you anything that you didn't know. Denver hit 22 3-point shots in this game today. 22.
There are three, yeah, they take a lot, and there's some games they're going to hit 22, and there's other games where they take a lot, and they're going to hit 11.
Yeah.
Tomorrow, it was a winnable game. It stings.
It was.
Jazz fans. I know it hurts.
Yeah, it does. It does. I think we started off the playoff bubble in epic fashion. I enjoyed the game thoroughly. I'm looking forward to Wednesday's game. Tomorrow we have a full slate of games that'll be entertaining as well. Right now, Boston and Philadelphia just tipping off in that contest. 12-10 Boston right now, so it's neck and neck out of the gate. I think that's going to be a phenomenal game as well. I'm looking forward to talking more basketball on the show tomorrow. Also, we're going to be joined by Coach John Famala with the Emory Spartans. That game on Friday, that stung as well.
Yeah, Emory was the better team. They should have won. They got a touchdown taken off the board.
Two
of them. Questionable calls. It was a winnable game. They should have won that game, but you regroup. You go into North Stampede, who, you know, exploded 47 last week. But you can go in there and beat North Stampede.
And we'll talk about that game on the show tomorrow. We'll also talk more NBA basketball in the bubble. We'll have 4 more games tomorrow. The final game 1 set of the opening round. They'll wrap up tomorrow. He's Travis Anderson. I'm Jordan Buscarini. Always fun to be along with you on the afternoon drive. Be safe. We are out.